Darker Than Blue by Willis and Shantae of Positive Light Ministry. And a shout out to Willis and Shantae's, whose short play Kiara in Wendell was picked as one of the 10-minute plays for the NAACP Festival coming up the weekend of August the 24th and 25th. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you from Skid Row Studios with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Our call-in number is 800-893-9562. Listen to us live or download our show and any past show by Googling in skidrow.la and hit Qumran Report. Now, this week on the Qumran Report, we will talk to Michael Blaze and Dre Shikas of the Veterans Photography Club, Aisha Mason and Andy Griggs from ICUJP talking about the third George Reed Award. And I also will be talking to Samantha Ciora about the charity event at the Vortex this Saturday, August the 17th, 2013. But first, I would like to update you on the prison hunger strike that is protesting long-term solitary confinement, which is torture. Now, the hunger strike began July the 8th, 2013. This is day 36, and we will hear more about the prison hunger strike in our roundtable session at the last part of the show. Now, here with us on the line, Samantha Ciora from the organization Face to Face, and she's going to talk about a charity event coming up this Saturday at the Vortex. Samantha, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Hello, thank you.
Samantha, can you tell us, our listening audience, about your organization and how did you get involved?
Oh, sure. I started Face to Face in November of last year. And basically, I moved to downtown Los Angeles 2 years ago, and I was heartbroken to see so many people struggling on Skid Row. And a lot of people that are just like you and me, artists, musicians, creators, actors, inspiring people with so much to share. And, you know, we live in a society which leaves no room for us to thrive as artists. And I happen to be very blessed among a community of artists who share a passion to help and create change. After volunteering at job help centers and various low-income housing systems, serving food and giving out clothing, I realized that most donations made by the people never reach the people who need it. So I decided to deliver the goods myself and prove the delivery on video. So my mission really is to bring art, music, and life enrichment to the people that need it. From information on how to get food stamps to sketchbooks and musical instruments, as well as food, clothes, and hygiene products.
Okay.
And, yeah, so the donations just keep coming in, and my home is now a donation center. And so.
Well, can you talk about the fundraising event coming up this Saturday, August the 17th, 2013, at the Vortex, which is located at 2341 East Olympic Boulevard? And some of the entertainment that you have?
Oh, sure. I have a team of about 35 artists and performers, and we've linked up with St. Francis Center, the UUCP Center, and the Qumran Program to bring a fundraising event called Face to Heart. The sole mission of this event is to bring awareness to the community through visuals played on screen to performances acted out by the group of Drama Stage, yourself included. We have lots of entertainment planned from live painters, aerial performers, fire performers, a yoga class, healing tea ceremonies, live musicians, and a clothing swap. So you bring your old clothes and you can take a few home with you, and we'll end up with massive amounts of donations that we'll be able to donate to Skid Row.
Okay. Now, also, can you discuss your involvement with the homeless and how a portion of the funds would go to the homeless for winter hygiene kits like socks, face cloth, gloves, pullover caps, and hygiene items?
Yeah, I mean, after all the planning involved, I still get asked, you know, how does this help the homeless situation, and why can't we get to the source of the economic structure that is at fault here? And my answer is that this is a learning process, and definitely our purpose with the event is to start a chain of events across the country which will bring compassion to the people and action to the non-homeless. I understand that I'm not in a government position, so I can't at this time provide a solution to the problem, but I can start by giving people some of what they need in the process. So that is providing hope. So from our event, we will be donating 20% of the money made and 100% of the donations made to the charities.
Okay.
So the money will go to the Peace Center and Drama Stage for purchase of hygiene kits. As we all know, the health of the people on Skid Row is diminishing, and we must take action to help and to give hope to generate enough money to really make a difference.
Okay. Samantha, now what is the contact information for those that want to get in touch with you to be involved and to contribute?
Well, you have a few options to get involved. You can either donate funds to the cause, or you can attend the event and donate when you arrive, either cash or physical items like food, clothing, or other hygiene items. You can bring those. We're asking for brand new underwear and socks because these are things that people really need. To do that, you can visit our event page, Face to Heart, and it's FACE, the number 2, Heart, HEART, eventbrite.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make a charitable donation on there. You can purchase a ticket to the event. The other option is to RSVP to our email, which is facetofacegorilla@yahoo.com. And the spelling on that is FACE, the number 2, FACE, GURILLA@yahoo.
Okay, Samantha. And we're looking forward to it because Drama Stage will be over there doing a 15 to 20 minute skit from our play Nailheads about the homeless. And we're looking forward to that.
Oh, we are too. At 9:45, you guys are on.
Okay.
We look forward to it.
All right, then. Thank you, Samantha.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Right, that's Samantha. Nice fundraising event that they got coming up at the Vortex. Now, I'm delighted to have with us in the studio Aisa Mason. She is the Associate Regional Director for the West Region of the American Friends Service Committee and one of the three recipients of the third George Revis Award, and sitting in with her is Andy Griggs, Program Director of ICUJP. Welcome to the Qumran Report.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
First, let's start off with Aisha. Can you tell us a little about your background and how did you get involved with the American Friends Service Committee?
Well, I serve as the Associate Regional Director for our West Region, and I've been with the American Friends Service Committee for about 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I first became involved with them when I worked for another organization, and we began partnering on projects together to really revitalize the conversation around nonviolence and be able to share more of the technology of using nonviolence as an effective tool in struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And when I decided I really wanted to learn more and to work with an organization that had a broad reach, and AFSC is an international, almost 100-year-old organization, then the door opened for me to be able to start working with them.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. Now, exactly what is the American Friends Service Committee? Can you
say a little bit about that?
Yeah, tell us about
that. It's a Quaker-based organization, and the Quakers are a faith community that actually were involved in the founding of the colony of Pennsylvania. And Quakers, even though it is a Quaker-based organization, many of us who are employed by AFSC are not Quakers, but we share common values. There's a saying among Quakers that they see that of God in every human being. That's what their commitment is. And so those of us who work with AFSC recognize the dignity and worth of every human being. We share the values of simplicity, equality, peacemaking, and reconciliation. The work is very, very diverse, really attuned to the needs of each community. But just here in the West region, we have 11 offices and 18 programs that span from Seattle down to San Diego and then all the way over to Denver, Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Now, something I always wondered about, maybe you can, I always wondered, where did that name Quakers come from? Any meaning to that name? Or I should have pulled it up on the Wikipedia.
I am not an authority on Quaker faith tradition. I better not even mention there because I don't want to spread a myth.
Well, let me tell you why I always loved the Quakers. When I started reading history, and I found out that the Quakers was one of the early organizations that was against slavery.
Yeah.
And I always loved them for that. I said, hey, I like them. They got to be okay if they're against slavery. Before we move over to Andy Griggs, ICUJP is here with us. Let me just ask you quickly on your thoughts on jobs and after-school programs for our young people. Can you comment in on that? What do you think?
There have been so many commissions to investigate, what do young people need and how come they get involved in gangs? And it's the same commission over and over again with a different name when the answer is clearly they need opportunities, they need skills, and they need jobs. They need to find a way to have dignity just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So AFSC has a priority of working with young people with a particular focus of developing young community organizers and supporting that next generation. Our program here in Los Angeles is directed by a gentleman named Anthony Marsh, and we work with high school students at three different high schools that represent different parts of our community. We're in the Mar Vista Housing Projects, we're at Lincoln High School, and we're at All People's School. And we begin working with young people to introduce them to personal leadership skills and then how to begin to impact their community through gardens that the students have developed at each school. And over the very recent few years, we've seen how the garden is actually becoming part of the community so that it starts with high school students, but in one of the schools, they've started a second garden for elementary school kids and parents. And in our housing project, we are working with the management of the housing project to start a community garden there for residents so they can raise their own food.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also seeing, in some cases, where youth become knowledgeable enough to begin to perhaps earn money and get jobs in teaching gardening.
Mm, okay. All right, let me just move over to Ann there a minute. Can you tell our listening audience, what is ICUJP? And then the George Regas Award.
Well, first I should probably say what ICUJP stands for.
Yes.
Which it stands for Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. And ICUJP started shortly after 9/11 of 2001. And actually, Aisha joined the group very shortly after it began. I mean, within weeks, George Regas and many other faith leaders, community leaders, came together and said, and lay leaders, of course, not just the people of the cloth or priests and rabbis, but they came together knowing that the result of what happened on 9/11 was going to be probably involving two to three things. One was the idea that we had to have retribution, that we had to get revenge, that we had to go back in kind to whoever did this. The second was that there was going to be a rash of Islamophobia. And third, there was this going to be this rash of super patriotism. All three of those, of course, have come to pass, sadly. But ICUJP has stayed the road for almost 12 years now with the theme that religious communities must stop blessing war and violence. And that has involved, over the years, it has involved a number of things, ranging from civil disobedience, anti-war demonstrations, We now have, we've also, though, recognized that the violence that's happening overseas and the wars is also visited daily in our communities and in the country. We became involved very closely with National Religious Campaign Against Torture and the aspects of torture that after which were described after Guantanamo and the discovery of what was going on at Abu Ghraib. We also have worked with a number of community groups in terms of community policing, some of the spying that's gone on. We've spoken out against the NSA. At the same time, expanding our reach and talking about drone warfare and, of course, the use of drones locally. And torture has been a major aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And so we have been very involved with support for the prison hunger strike and everything that's going on around that. And tied into that, of course, is what's happening not only on the state level and internationally, but even in our own, the county sheriff, and the issues of abuse and the idea of building a brand new women's jail. Mm-hmm. Instead of thinking about a place of rehabilitation and rejuvenation of people who have, it's been a talk about punishment and keeping people aside, and that goes for all of mass incarceration issues. So we've gone quite a few things, and what we've done is one of our major fundraisers has been over the last 2 years and now going into our third is the George Regas Courageous Peacemaker Award, which on our 10th anniversary was first awarded to George Regas as one of our, as our founder. Last year, we recognized and honored, and that was done at his home church, which was All Saints Church in Pasadena. Last year, we recognized Reverend James Lawson, and we recognized him at his home church, Holman United Methodist Church. This year, we said, at the rate we're going, we're not gonna get enough awards out there. So there are too many peacemakers out there who deserve to be recognized. And we decided we're working with three awards this year.
That's great.
We're going to be honoring Rabbi Leonard Bierman, who has been involved in anti-nuclear work, anti-Islamophobia work. He's been a bridge builder all his life. Dr. Maher M. Hatut, who is currently, Leonard Bierman was the founding rabbi of the Leo Beck Temple in Beverly Hills. And Dr. Maher M. Hatut, who is a founder of the Muslim Public Affairs Committee.
And the Islamic Center.
And also involved with the Islamic Center here downtown, and is... And interestingly enough, Leonard Bierman and Maher have been called, along with George Regas, have been called the Holy Triumvirate. I came across that usage of their names together recently. And we also decided to recognize the work of Aisha Mason, who has done amazing work in these areas, not only through her work with AFSC, but in all her previous work as well. And we're calling it Three Journeys Towards Peace. And we will be having an event on Sunday, September 8th to honor these. And this time we're doing it at the Agape International Spiritual Center in Culver City, which Aisha has been a part of. And so we continue to tradition to try and have our events at a home of one of the honorees.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing that. It's on Sunday, September 8th, 5 p.m., a ticketed reception. At 7 p.m. will be the program. got some amazing things lined up. The Agape Choir will be performing with Dr. Ricky Byers Beckwith. And we've got the main part of the program will be really an historic event. And by the way, I should mention the 7 p.m. program is free. So the fundraising, you know, we'll pass the hat, but the fundraising will be happening at the reception as well. And we hope that people will come. But basically what the main part of the program on that Sunday evening will be a discussion between the three honorees, and which will be moderated by George Regas himself. So It will be a discussion to remember, talking about their three journeys and where they still have to go.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. Looking forward to that. And we'll be coming back later because we're going to bring you back, you and Aisha, into the roundtable discussion about the prison hunger strike after the community calendar. Now, at this time, I'd like to turn to our other two in-studio guests, Michael Blaze and Dre Shikas, from the Veterans Photography Club. Welcome to the Qumran Report.
It's good to be here.
Okay.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, let's start off over and start with Dre. Can you tell our listening audience about your background and how did you get involved with the Photography Club?
Sure. So I consider myself a community activist in the Christian faith. I've been an educator for more than 10 years, and I'm also an artist in film and photography. And I actually became involved in the Skid Row Photography Club 5 years ago. And through Blaze's mentorship, I actually learned the model of low-cost programming. And so learning from him, I took the model and started my own youth programs in photography in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle. And so as a lifetime member of the Skid Row Photography Club, that extension has grown to being a member to the Veterans Photography Club, which is Blaze's latest efforts. And I'm so excited to support him all the way from my home for the last 2 years, which is Seattle, Washington.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So, Blaze, can you tell us about exactly what is the Veterans Photography Club?
Well, first of all, let me say thank you very much for having us. I really appreciate it from you and Earlene. And Earlene is a founding member of the Skid Row Photography Club, and she still has a camera going into the sixth year. I think the only surviving camera from the first. So Earlene takes care of things.
Yes.
So Skid Row Photography Club was the foundation for veterans in photography as far as me gathering information about it. The most important thing about photography is that you have to understand in the modern day, it covers so many different areas. Film, photography, blogging, social media, photojournalism. It really just depends on who the camera, whose hands the camera's in at a certain time. So one of the primary things that we've always found is that it's a unifier. You know, in the Skid Row Photography Club, we have younger people, older people, Caucasian, you know, all kinds of different nationalities come together, and that really doesn't happen a great deal in too many places. Most places are very, very segregated, you know, and I mean really and truly. So any event, so I came to an end of doing that. That was really just a play to bring a safe haven in Skid Row where there was no drugs and no alcohol. We chose photography later because I'm a filmmaker, so we chose photography later, but it was really just safe haven. People would pull up in their shopping carts, and I'm happy to say last year, 8 people gained housing, jobs, you know, re-entered society. So, you know, it's I say photography is better than drugs. And I'm talking about that so-called legal medication.
Yeah,
we've
right.
never had an argument. We don't really have political discussions per se. You know, the whole thing is very, it's photo therapy. We go great places and we take shots of things, you know, just like any other person, but it's a unifier. Then when you look back on these images, you see, hey, we were out of Skid Row. Really, we went out of Skid Row all the time to, you know, really great places. So with Veterans in Photography, the idea is this is not a Skid Row program, although, and we're in partnership with Social Model Recovery, USEP, and it's located in Skid Row for the time being because we got a great spot there, right? Mm-hmm. But it's really about downtown L.A. and veterans. So a large part of what we're going to be doing this time around, yeah, we'll take pictures, but primarily we're going to seek out veterans all over. I've kind of slowed down, opened it up, because D-Link, Downtown Neighborhood Council, was good enough to fund us a couple of $1,000s to get started properly. As Drea said, it's a very, it doesn't really cost a lot. It's digital, shoot over and over, over and over, over and over. It really does not cost a great deal at all to start a photography club, and I think everyone should have it now. One thing Drea didn't really clearly say is she's focused on youth, and she's found a way to reach youth where they have a chance to express themselves and grow. What age group usually?
So I do 12 to 14.
See, so it applies to every age and everybody involved. So anyway, what we're going to be doing is going out and finding a way to communicate with various veterans. You know, it's not about the homeless thing. It has to be broader than Skid Row. Mm-hmm. It's about poverty. You know, there's this thing called poverty line. It's dependent upon how much you make annually, period. Mm-hmm. Not whether you live in Skid Row or whether you don't. And these are the issues I think people should be becoming more aware of instead of this thing about homelessness. Mm-hmm. And in closing, let me just say, you know, I've lived in Skid Row myself for about over a decade, right? And I constantly hear people, we're going to end homelessness in 5 years. Every one of these individuals get millions of dollars to do this. Now, if they end homelessness just by 20%, the next year, their millions of dollars are going to be cut by 20%. If they end homelessness by 50%, next year, their things are going to be cut by 50%. Are they going to do that? Of course not. Do they even have a chance of ending homelessness? No. No way in the world are they going to do that. But we can deal with poverty, and we can begin to involve people who are close to homelessness and people who are homeless. I just feel the word poverty is really important. You know, mm-hmm. I really do.
Okay. So. Now, how do the Veterans Photography Club, because, you know, a lot of veterans, because of being veterans and coming out of a war situation, most of them is dealing with traumatic situations. How do the Veterans Photography Club help them deal with that?
Well, for one thing, during the entire 5-year run of Skid Row Photography Club, maybe a third of the people were always veterans. Mm-hmm. It was always veterans. Many of the people in Veterans Photography were members of Skid, you know, we always had veterans. And like I said, it is so therapeutic. And those 5 years of usually we used to meet twice a week, right? 2 hours, that's 4 hours a week. Never an argument. Mm-hmm. Never any drugs. Never any drinking. It wasn't, all I can say is there's truly a place for phototherapy that outweighs drugs, outweighs homelessness. Like I said, people would pull up in their shopping carts, you know, and park their car or drop their bags and participate as an equal. You know, in terms of expressing yourself with a camera, you don't need a degree. It doesn't matter where you live, you know. So what I do is my real thing in life is I give away cameras, mm-hmm. right? And then I analyze the individual I give it to as best I can and aim them in that direction because, you know, it's technology. There's no one way to do it. Next week there's a new thing. So I aim that in a certain direction and give them some pointers, and it's a do-for-self program. So it's very involving with people to get in. You know, when we first started, people didn't even know what an email was. I mean, 5 years, things have changed, but people didn't even know how to, you know. So now they, you know, learn to upload, learn to, you know, project their lives. And that's what we want to do. We want people to just be happy. So there really are no rules. Mm-hmm. It's about, you know, how do you feel about this? What can I help you with? Some people come and just sit there. We have a guy, we just gave him his camera. I'm not going to say his name, right? He's been coming like for 2 years, right? So when we move from Skid Row Photography Club to Veterans Photography. After about 4 weeks, I said, well, are you a vet? He said, mm-hmm. He hardly ever talks, right? So this week, he got a camera. I've never, ever seen him talk and smile. I was like, well, he's the one that really needed it. And it has that effect on people of all ages. And so it doesn't seem like a lot, but there truly is something to phototherapy that more people of all walks of life should look into. And that's part of our mission. We reach out to people and try to get them to start clubs and give them cameras.
Mm-hmm. Phototherapy, I like that. Yeah. Now, let me ask you
better
this.
Than drugs.
Let me ask you this question. You know, one of the things that we are trying to do right now in the Skid Row area is we want to do a movie. We had a script, Surviving the Nickel, about the Skid Row. I've already...
It seems to me I was at the first play at USF. In the same room where we do our
that's exactly.
Thing. Okay,
that's
try to remember
started.
That.
That's exactly. Started right there.
In the very same room.
With O.J. and Charles, and he's playing two of the roles.
There you go.
But I found these two incredible musicians. I think you know them, Willis and Shantae. As a matter of fact, that was the opening song that they opened the show with, Darker Than Blue. And I have those two line up to do the score, the musical score for this. Now, given the right amount of funds and equipment and the script, because the script's going to be there because I'm going to put the script together, so I know it's going to be the script for it. Would the Skid Row Photography Club be able to shoot a movie?
Michael Blaze is a filmmaker. Skid Row Photography Club is like what I do with the community.
But Michael Blaze.
There's also Skid Row Films and Michael Blaze. Yeah. No, I can shoot that. But I think more importantly, the term Surviving the Nickel is very important. There are so many people that come through Skid Row, and people that are one step away from homelessness should keep this in mind. Many people come to Skid Row and recover. They just don't show you that because they want to hustle the money, mm-hmm. tell you everybody's homeless. Many, many people come through Skid Row. In the Weingart, they have a fantastic veterans program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many, many people actually recover in Skid Row. I've seen people come and go. Come, get it together, fall down, come back, you know, and recover. So Surviving the Nickel is very important because it breaks us out of this thing where everybody is home. You know, in Skid Row is what? 60, 70 apartment buildings, you know, people don't really live on the street in Skid Row, just the ones you see. But most mm-hmm. of the people in Skid Row live in housing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have to have this surviving thing. We really do, because many people, myself, you know, I don't use drugs, I don't drink, you know, I lived there for economical reasons, and it didn't faze me at all, you know, through the grace of God. But I'm just saying, so Surviving the Nickel is a great thing, and I would love an opportunity to do
uh-huh,
that.
Uh-huh.
And your check will be in the mail.
Okay. One more little question before we take a break for our community calendar. This is for Dre. What projects are you working on now?
Well, currently I'm in L.A. because I'm working with the Freedom School Program, which is a literacy program through the Children's Defense Fund. And I'm in Linwood, California with a literacy organization called Read Lead. So shout out to them. And really what the Freedom School Program is about is to increase self-confidence among children and youth, and really to inspire them to fall in love with reading. And through that, teaching them how they can make a difference in themselves, their family, their community, the world, and how they can be involved in social action projects.
Mm-hmm. And what degree did you just earn?
And I just recently graduated with a degree in transformational leadership from Seattle University. Hmm. So I am newly minted as a graduate student. I'm very proud of that. It took a lot of hard work. And I'm also going to return to Seattle and work in faith-rooted organizing efforts with the community-based organization called Urban Impact. And so I'll be starting youth art programs in photography, writing, and working on community outreach programs.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. A few weeks ago, we had Tony Brown, mm-hmm. who is the executive director of OLA. He found, great after-school program in the MacArthur Park area. Mm-hmm. And I was asking him what was the key to setting up a great after-school program that sustains itself. And one of the things that he said that really stuck out in my mind is he said that the people who set up these after-school programs must be consistent. Mm-hmm. You know, if you could say you're going to have an after-school program every week,
right?
You know, as far as these youngsters is concerned and the confidence that they have in their community, it's important to follow up on that. What are your thoughts on that in terms of working with young people?
Well, I definitely see after-school care as a small part of a more holistic approach, and that is to address the social, spiritual, and material poverty of an area. And so when I say social poverty, I mean the poverty of, like, do young people feel like they belong to their community? Are they connected to something greater than themselves? The spiritual poverty is, are they connected to God, to a spiritual source? I call him Jesus. And so that's the lens that I work through. And then finally, the material poverty is, are their basic needs being met? And so do these after-school programs have a snack or some sort of food that really nourishes their bodies? And then, of course, the parental involvement is huge. How are you involving their parents? How are you making this about a tribe, a collective, a community? And so it's really a lot of layers. It's a lot of hard work and definitely consistency and dedication and people who care about addressing the different levels of poverty.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's great.
I'll tell you what, let's take a break for our community calendar, and then we open this up for our roundtable. I think we got a lot of interesting subjects to talk about.
This is the community calendar for the month of August. The Veterans Community Theater Workshop will be held this Tuesday, August the 13th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. The location is the Vortex. That's 2341 East Olympic Boulevard. That's right at the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic. The Metro bus number 60 and 66 stops right at or near the corner. And the participants are currently working and rehearsing a 10-minute play for the NAACP Festival of Short Plays. For more information on the community workshop, you can call 213-479-1764. And this is a two-day event that Samantha gave us information on earlier. Face to Heart will be a fundraising event over 2 days, Saturday, August 17th at 7 p.m. That will go over to Sunday, August the 18th at 12 in the morning. And the location is also at the Vortex. Tuesday, August the 27th at 7 p.m., Drama Stage Qumran Nasana Play Reading Series present Filthy Rags, a stage play written and directed by Daryl Phillips. The mixer and music will begin at 7 p.m. and the play reading will begin at 8 p.m. This is a free event. Also, there is free parking. All are invited to attend, and the location is the Vortex. And for more information, you can call 213-479-1764. These are upcoming guests on the Qumran Report. Monday, August the 19th will be Aaron Jennings and Iman Milner. These are two actors from the recent Roby Theater Company production of Bronzeville. Monday, August the 26th will be Lynn Mannings. He's an award-winning poet, playwright, actor, and co-founder of the Los Angeles Watts Village Theater Company. And these are special announcements. Andy already reiterated, but I will say Sunday, August the 8th, the George Regas Courageous Peacemaking Award, reception at 5 p.m., the program at 7 p.m. The location is the Agape International Spiritual Center, 5700 Buckingham Parkway, Culver City. For more information on this special event, you can call 213-748-1643. And this is a new show to air at the Skid Row Studios, Sunday, September the 8th at 6 p.m. Judith Bowman and Eric Bolmer will debut their new show. And the name of the show is Spotlight on Books. And more information will be forthcoming on this new show. And again, if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. And the call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Earlene Anthony. Now we're going to open up our round table. I want to talk a little. This is day 36 of the prison hunger strike, and I want to open it up for the discussion. The first thing I want to throw out to the round table is, how does the prison hunger strike affect the rest of the community? I want to open up. Anyone will pick up on that?
I can start this, Andy. First of all, I have trouble answering that question without first answering or trying to answer the question, is how does the prison and criminal justice system affect the community? And with California having 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prison population, I think you can say that the prison system affects our community deeply. Families, the people around, the schools, the programming, the costs, it's immense. How does the prison hunger strike affect our community? I think has to do with, again, the families that have been affected by this, and the men and women inside the prisons who are suffering the abuses of 23 and a half hours a day without seeing the light of day in a 10 by 10 cage. I think that's going to affect people whether they ever get released or not. And I think it's going to affect our community. I think what you see also in terms of the reaction to it is, and the support that these strikers are getting is incredible and untold for years. We see rallies, we see letters being written, we see the governor and all the others being held to task for this. And hopefully we'll see an end to it, a humane end to it, and a realization that we have to really realign what our thinking is.
Okay. Aisha?
I actually think that the hunger strike is going to have tremendous impact. I think it is going to be successful in terms of changing conditions of solitary confinement and inching us toward ultimately abolishing the practice of solitary confinement. But I think where they have already had tremendous influence is that they are altering the general public perception of who these people are. And they have been demonized and put in this very narrow box of being the most violent, the most terrible people who deserve this treatment. And through this self-sacrifice in fasting, they have challenged people to rethink their perceptions of who these men are. And through these men's willingness to do what Dr. King would have called redemptive suffering, they are demonstrating their humanity and representing themselves as people of dignity, and it's being caught in the public conscience, both their imagination and conscience. That alone is an incredible victory, because now that the way they are held in the minds and the hearts of people is not as this, not necessarily as the enemy who deserves to be this way, but as a fellow human being. And people are questioning the assumptions they made in the past. That's a huge victory.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Blady Stray, you want to say something about this prison hunger strike, what's happening there, how it affects the community?
Well, I have mixed opinions about the entire, it's not just people that live in little cells for 23 hours. You know, I mean, I'm sorry for that. But it's about a whole mess of society that's just been put in a prison cell. Mm-hmm. And the most they can do is work. So the prison industry is a money-making business. I mean, if I had the contract just to supply toilet paper alone, I'd retire. Mm-hmm. You know, or toothpick, I retire. You know, so it's big business, and it's very structured to a point where there's family and friends and members and communities and towns that all make big money off of this without any thought or consideration to rehabilitation. So without rehabilitation, and all that means is, you know, I figure what the statistics are for people in there in terms of having a high school diploma, in terms of being able to read and write. But you have their complete attention for 24 hours a day. Why not give them an education? Why not give them hope? Why not allow them to re-enter society? You know, other than that, when people get out of prison, they get $200 and a whole lot of threats. Mm-hmm. And that's it. But the first day they get arrested, the system spends about $2,000. So they're not designing to let these people out. They're going to be prisoners for the rest of their life. They're going to keep coming back and back because nothing is changing when they're in there. So me, myself, I believe in humans all over the world being able to recover from being a criminal or recover, because usually it's the circumstances of their environment. You know, and many people in prison right now are there, well, the truth is because they had a public defender. No representation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the truth. You know, and I speak, I've been in prison, right? Mm-hmm. Luckily, you know, I mean, I wasn't there for, you know, big time things. I wasn't there for much time or anything like that. I wasn't involved with level 2, 3, 4, none of that really makes a big difference. But I've seen people in San Quentin walking, like, you know, waiting to be killed, and they stay there for like 20 years and nobody kills them, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous and it's out of control and there's no accountability and it's wrong and it's slavery, and that's what it is. It's a form of slavery where no one can recover. You can't recover from that. You really can't. The best you could do is maybe come out and get a job sweeping the street. And that's wrong, with rare exceptions. And mm-hmm. that's wrong, you know?
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I condemn all of it. That's all I'm mm-hmm. getting at.
The issues that are some of the issues that you raise, are, we have to look at the prison industrial complex as an industry. Mm-hmm. And that means there's a profit motive involved. And today, although the SHU is a state-run or a federal prison, there's so much prison privatization and an ever-widening circle of it, based where people become commodity. They are a way to make money.
Let me share what I shared before the show began. About 8 years ago, I got curious. So I contacted them, and I said I wanted to purchase whatever they're making, furniture, whatever it is they're making, right? Oh, they told me, oh, no, I can't play. That's only for their homies, their families, and their friends. You can't even purchase. It's all hooked up, right? So they have slave labor that they're using state money to create and people, you know, but you can't participate in purchasing and benefiting from these products that they're making. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? That means it's an entire industry. It's not just the prison. It's the whole. They're just making money. It's slavery, and the whole thing should be condemned. So I'm glad they have this hunger strike, and it might take people to it, but it's more than that. People have to be willing to get out and do something, you know. Mm-hmm. And in closing, I covered so many people with Trayvon Martin. We saw the outcome. So when people get out and do something, or there's this hunger strike, and then when it's over, it's just over, and it's business as usual. That won't work. These people shouldn't be in prison. They really shouldn't. Most of them are busted for a $5 crack.
Let me also throw this out. And it's the last year when they had the prison hunger strike, and they still had a five four demands. And one of the demands, I felt then like I feel now, that this was one of the most critical one and the hardest one to come to any kind of agreement on. And that was this thing that they call debriefing, you know, which is snitching. You know, it goes way back in history and definitely way back in the United States when you want to talk with J. Edgar Hoover, how he developed his informants to build up the COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program. And what are your thoughts on the continued inclusion of this concept of the system giving up debriefing as one of the five core demands? But anybody want to pick up on that?
What is debriefing? Debriefing
is a concept where most of they would take a gang member, right, and they put him in the SHU, Security Housing Union, unit, and for him to get out of the Security Housing Unit, he would have to give up another gang member or somebody.
Are we calling snitching by some other name?
That's what they call it within the prison industrial complex. They call it debriefing. That's right. What they call that concept. A person have to, if you want to get out of the SHU, you got to debrief. And to debrief, you got to give up on one of your gang members or somebody that might be involved in gang activity to get up out of the SHU.
Give up somebody who may not have anything to do with it.
Yeah,
right.
Because they have been worn so worn down by, you know, and I think, you know, you and I have had this conversation, Melvin, and you and I disagree respectfully on it, but I think that I think that's got to be a key issue in the demands. Whether they'll get anywhere with it is another question. You know, but I understand why it's part of the demands, and I think, you know, I've thought about it since our last conversation about it, and I think that basically it's just an additional part of torture. You know, I mean, we see these shows on TV. You know, you see 24. And you see these people tortured and tortured and tortured until ultimately they give up the information and it saves the world. And that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. And there are more people in a prison who will not participate in the SHU. If they want to have the SHU shut down and that aspect of it, it's not just talking about people who are involved in gang activities or even anything like that, because people are naming names in order to sometimes just to the point where they can't take it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Just to get up out of there. Mm-hmm.
So
okay, the other thing I want to mention, I guess, when you read, because I know you're deeply involved in the Christian faith, the scripture. Right. And I want to mention, when I think about that, I think about an individual in the scripture who was in solitary confinement, and that was John the Baptist. When you read the story of John the Baptist, you see that they held him in isolation like that for a long time. But before we leave here, I want to give one more thing about this prison thing, and then we're going to go around for some closing comments and contact information. And that's the whole thing of a different form of realignment. Realignment, I think, started in October or something like that, and now the Supreme Court have forced the state of California to start opening up these overcrowded prisons. What are your thoughts on what's going to happen with that situation, and how can the community be more involved in community supervising some of these low-level offenders that are getting ready to hit the streets?
Let me just say, so they release these people into immediate homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all I have to say. They're going to be homeless.
Mm-hmm. Definitely a majority of them.
And homelessness is an art. If you're not used to being homeless, it's a real art to have to learn how to be homeless
to survive,
to be successful at it. You can't just be homeless and just, you have to really learn the art of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can't say what will happen, but I definitely have an opinion about what should happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that treatment and providing support services financially is way cheaper than keeping people incarcerated. It may not be profitable in the same way, but it certainly is far more economically sensible. But it's also what is moral, and it's what is humane. It's the kind of world we want to create. And our communities do need to be in a conversation now about how we can embrace people who come back into our community and support them, whether there is institutional support for them or not. And that's important because they're going to be among us. That's one part of it. But also because I think we need to rely more on ourselves more and more than mm-hmm. we do on official institutions that come and go, that mm-hmm. come and go. But there are already models out there that will support people coming home. And they don't have to, recycle right back into the system.
Okay.
One other thing I want to say mm-hmm. about that is there are private corporations who are ready to help people come back into the community and not be in prison by offering, we'll manage probation for you, we'll manage ankle bracelets for you, we'll manage mental health services for you as a private for-profit business. And the problem with that is when you're in it for profit, you've got to get more people into it so that you increase your profit. So the community's got to step up and provide those services to keep those corporations out.
Okay.
And from the perspective of young people, you know, the prison problem really affects us. And the United States is one of the few countries in the entire world that gives life sentences to young people. And the Children's Defense Fund came out with a study that said 1 in 3 black boys born after the year 2001 will end up in prison. 1 in 6 Latino boys and 1 in 17 white boys. Mm. So it's a huge disparity. And, you know, just to close, because I know we don't have that much time, the prison problem for me is really a spiritual problem. So when you look at the characters in the Bible that were in prison, you talk about Paul, you talk about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, there was always a supernatural response to breaking the chains. You know, Paul, earthquake struck. And so I think that the response of the church should be really as the body of Christ to be the healing hands, walking feet, and comforters through the Spirit to those who are incarcerated. To really work with families, because, again, it's a holistic problem. It's not just those who are incarcerated, but it's the children and also the young people who are in probation camps.
Okay. And, Drake, can you give us your contact information for those who want to contact you? Then we'll move over to Michael Blaze.
Definitely. I'm at filmingjustice@gmail.com and also DreaChicas@gmail.com.
Okay. And Brother Blaze.
I just want to say we have meetings once a week on Tuesdays from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. You can call me and contact me at 213-784-5183. I'm really dying to get female veterans. I don't think I'm really running a proper program without female veterans, since that's the reality of the world today. Also, we're located at 800 East 6th Street, that's the corner of Stanford, 90021, and you can contact me at veteransinphotography.com. Okay, and veterans in, that's enough. So call in if you need any more information.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Aisha, your contact information?
I can be found at the American Friends Service Committee, which is AFSC, AmericanFriendsServiceCommittee.org, and you just mm-hmm. look up Los Angeles.
Okay. Andy.
Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. You can just write me at andy@icujp.org. And if you're interested in the Regus Award, information, it's RegusAward2013@gmail.com.
Okay. And I'm definitely, the next time I see Anthony, he's going to have to give me a definition of Quakers so I can get that off my mind. Now, I would like to extend a special Next week on the Qumran Report, we will have Iman Milner and Aaron Jennings, two young talented actors recently seen in the excellent Roby Theater production of Bronzeville. Mm-hmm. I would like to extend a special thanks to Aisha Mason, Andy Griggs, Michael Blaze, Dre Chicas, and on the line with Samantha Ciara and my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report on iTunes, Facebook, Stitcher, and SkidRow.LA. And I leave you with the tune that opened the show, Darker Than Blue by Willis and Shantae.